Imagine prisoners that have spent their entire lives chained deep inside a cave. They have been chained so that they cannot see behind themselves, and they are forced to stare endlessly at the cave wall in front of them. Behind them, a fire is burning, and between the prisoners and the fire is a raised walkway. Now imagine that each day a menagerie of objects crosses the walkway. Animals and people carrying their wares to market. Their shapes create an intricate shadow play on the wall in front of the prisoners. This is the only world that the prisoners have ever known. The shadows and the echoes of unseen objects. Now, imagine that a prisoner is released. After some time adjusting to the blinding light, the freed prisoner will begin to experience the world outside of the cave for the very first time. And it is like nothing he could have ever imagined. With his new perception of the world, the man will of course want to return to his friends to share his incredible discoveries. But the prisoners cannot recognize their old friend. He appears as all things do. His voice is a distorted echo, and his body is a grotesque shadow. They cannot understand his fantastic stories of the world outside of the cave. To them, it will never exist. This, of course, does not make the world outside of the cave any less real.
That was Plato's Allegory of the Cave, narrated by Christopher Hudson. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 127. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Dr. Peter Glidden, ND, titled Killing Us Softly, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of Doctors, and is being released on Sunday, November 6, 2011. My interview with Peter was recorded on November 3, 2011. Dr. Peter Glidden is an outspoken advocate of holistic health. For more than two decades, he has been treating people with naturopathic therapeutics, including homeopathy, heavy metal chelation, herbal medication, and bioidentical hormone supplementation. Dr. Glidden received his BS degree from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He earned his ND from Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. He currently has a private naturopathic practice in Illinois. He is also a member of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians and the Illinois Association of Naturopathic Physicians. For more information, go to www.drglidden.com. That's Dr. or Dr. Glidden, GLIDDEN.com. And we still need more donations for equipment purchases, such as a microphone, headphones, and a couple of other things that are failing on us here. And upcoming shows next week, looks like Miguel Connor from Aeon Byte podcast will be here. And let's see, I'm not sure who will be on after that. I'll figure that out in the coming weeks. Donations. This episode is dedicated to Paul, Janet, David, Max, Michael, Kurt, Christopher, and Derek. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives or a t-shirt, or what I'm going to be releasing this week is a compilation of the first 3 years of Gnostic Media Podcast that will be available on the store page. So you can also get that to help support what we do here. And so we greatly appreciate your support with that. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Dr. Peter Glidden. Enjoy. Peter, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
Thank you so much, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I had a listener last week who was very adamant that I get a copy of your book, and actually they offered to send it to me, and usually, well, that's very rare when a listener actually offers to send me the book, which makes it much more likely that I'm going to review it and interview the guest than them just telling me to track down the information. So I got this copy of your book, and I read through it right away, and I was already familiar with many of the concepts and ideas in there, but you really lay out these concepts explicitly. But before we go into that, why don't you start off by telling us who is Dr. Peter Glidden and what is your educational background?
All right, very good. Yeah, well, I'm a licensed naturopathic physician. I've got over 20 years of clinical experience. I did my undergrad work at the University of Massachusetts, my pre-med. I got a BS in pre-med biology at the University of Massachusetts, 1987. Went to Bastyr University for naturopathic medicine in Seattle, Washington, graduated there in 1991 with my doctoral degree in naturopathic medicine, and became licensed to practice naturopathic medicine in 1992. And I've been involved in primary care naturopathic medical treatment ever since. I've done everything, you know, and I really feel like I've grown up with the holistic medical movement here in the United States, because before I became a naturopathic physician, I was an ardent advocate of yoga and meditation. I took a transcendental meditation course when I was 12 years old. I've always been involved in some fashion with the holistic medical movement. And it's been extremely rewarding since I've become a professional and licensed and trained. And in the last 2 years, I've been working exclusively with mentoring with one of the oldest naturopathic physicians in the world, Dr. Joel Wallach, and that's really increased my clinical skills of 1,000-fold. And I'm very, very excited to be talking about naturopathic medicine, because as God is my witness, it is one of the best kept secrets in the world as far as medicine goes.
How did you decide to become an MD?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was actually, when I was at UMass in the pre-med department, I was originally going to be a conventional MD. And in my senior year, I got really sick and nobody could help me. And I went to a number of different people, a number of different MD specialists, and I had fevers on and off and chills, and couldn't eat and was basically languishing in bed for almost 2 weeks, with abdominal pains that would come and go. And I was a pretty arrogant pre-med student, let's be honest. And I didn't know what a naturopathic doctor was, but the only naturopathic doctor, I was sure he was a quack, right? The only naturopathic doctor, as fate would have it, that worked in Massachusetts at that time, this was 1991, lived and worked in the same town that I lived in, Northampton, Massachusetts. So I begrudgingly went to see this guy. You know, I was carried into his office by two friends of mine. I'll never forget it. I was literally carried into this guy's office, and he was like an old-fashioned country doctor. That's kind of, you know, what I remember most about him. He put me on an exam table and poked around and drew some blood, asked me some questions, looked in a book, gave me a small vial, two or three pellets to take orally of a homeopathic medicine. And we waited for 5 minutes, and nothing happened. He scratched his chin, asked me a couple of other questions, gave me a different homeopathic medicine, and within 2 minutes of taking it, my body started shaking uncontrollably. I ran into the bathroom and purged probably, oh, I don't know, 8 to 10 ounces of this nasty bilious sludge. And as soon as that stuff left my body, I felt as if a Venetian blind had been unrolled from my toes all the way to my head, and I was cured. I was carried into this guy's office. I walked out of it, went home, slept for, I don't know, something like, you know, 15 hours. Woke up the next day, born again. And my life completely reversed. And 4 months later, I was a freshman at the naturopathic medical school that he went to. And it was a seminal moment in my life. My life took a dramatic turn for the better, and I've never looked back.
And what I'd like you to do, if you wouldn't mind, would you please read for us, starting at the bottom of your introduction, Roman numeral page 3 through the bottom of Roman numeral page 4?
Okay, here we go. And this is from my book entitled The MD Emperor Has No Clothes. In the 1800s and the early 1900s, the medical marketplace in the United States was quite different than it is today. The naturopaths, the chiropractors, the osteopaths, the herbalists, and the allopaths, the MDs, were all vying for patients, recognition, and turf. Many times, the competition between medical practitioners from different camps would even spill over into violence. In the 1800s, a medical group in Boston used a cannon aimed at the front door of their competitor's hospital to coerce them to cease and desist what they were doing. If you've ever seen the movie Gangs of New York, you'll have an idea of what I'm talking about. Even though there was a lot of competition in those days, the medical playing field was relatively level and nobody really had the upper hand. In the second decade of the 20th century, 1910 to 1920, there was, however, a dramatic shift of power in the medical arena and everything changed. A gentleman named Abraham Flexner was hired by the Carnegie Institute to tour the country and compile a list of all of the medical schools and hospitals that practiced MD-directed drug delivery medicine. This, of course, was well before the age of the internet, the airplane, and the interstate highway system. Flexner traveled the country mostly via train and stagecoach. 5 years after he started, Flexner returned with his list, which is historically referred to as the Flexner Report. The Carnegie Institute subsequently donated millions of dollars to the medical schools and hospitals on Flexner's list. Other groups, like the Rockefeller Foundation, followed the Carnegie Institute's lead and donated large sums of money to the medical schools, hospitals, and hospitals that delivered MD-directed prescription drug treatments. And can you guess why? Well, the Carnegies and Rockefellers were heavily invested in pharmaceutical companies. It was a good move. Within 10 years of the Flexner Report, the medical stage in the United States had completely shifted in favor of the MDs. By 1920, the medical turf war was over, and the MDs were squarely in the driver's seat of medicine. They have been there ever since. Most Americans, being unaware of these goings-on, mistakenly assume that MDs are in the driver's seat of medicine because their treatments are better than those of their competitors. But this couldn't be further from the truth. MDs are in the driver's seat of medicine only because of financial coalitions that were organized at the turn of the century. Or, an easier way to say it, MDs owe their preeminent medical and social status to drug money. Go figure.
And very good. And the interesting part of this is this same week that I read this in your book about Abraham Flexner and the Flexner Report, my friends and I run a media network, and my partner Richard Andrew Grove has been actually at this very same time investigating Abraham Flexner. So then here you come with this information, which ties directly into our other research and investigations that we've had going on. So tell us, what are allopathy, naturopathy, homeopathy, chiropractic, Chinese medicine, acupuncture, and how are they different?
Well, they basically break down into two distinct camps. The allopaths, the MDs, practice allopathic medicine, and it's reductionistic. Everybody else, the chiropractors, the homeopaths, the naturopaths, acupuncturists, Ayurvedic medical practitioners, herbalists, everybody else practices holistic medicine. And I'll get to that in a minute. But holistic medicine and reductionistic allopathic medicine are 180 degrees opposite each from the other. They're you know, like polar opposites, north and south, east and west, positive and negative, up and down. Allopathic MD-directed medicine is based on a reductionistic medical philosophy. What I do as a naturopath is based on a holistic medical philosophy. Now, reductionism argues, it's based on Newtonian physics, and it argues that the human body is a machine made of parts, and that when somebody is sick, they have to go to a physician whose job it is to take that body apart into the smallest possible piece.
Sort of like a car mechanic.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why when you go to an MD, you're lucky if you spend, you know, 2 minutes with the doctor and the rest of the time is spent with all of this technological discovery, blood work, urinalysis, stool analysis, x-ray, CT scan, MRI, right? It's all about the technological discovery because MDs are trained that the body is like an automobile. It's just a machine made of parts, and their job is to discover all of the parts that are broken, right? And then once a part is discovered that's defective or that's in trouble, because of their reductionistic philosophy, they're trained to deliver one medicine for each piece, but the medicines are rarely curative. The medicines that MDs deliver manage the illness. And, you know, you get one medicine for each piece. So you go to an MD, you get one medicine for your blood pressure, one medicine for your arthritis, one medicine for your insomnia, one medicine for your anxiety, one medicine for your heartburn, one medicine for your constipation, you know, and one medicine to take care of the side effects of all those medicines. Now, this isn't because MDs own stock in drug companies. You know, some of them do, but it's because their philosophical orientation tells them that this is what they must do. You know, it's reductionistic, based on Newtonian physics, and interestingly enough, this is also why there is no room in MD medical thought for anything metaphysical. You know, which is very ironic.
We should define metaphysical. Typically, metaphysics is the, you know, understanding of knowledge and things like that. So how does that fit into this?
Well, metaphysics specifically refers to as that which is beyond physical measurement, right? Metaphysics. For instance, the human soul, the existence of the human soul. Since nobody has ever dissected the soul out of a corpse, since no MRI or CT scan has ever revealed a measurable soul, to the allopathic MD, therefore it does not exist. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. This is Newtonian physics.
Now, is it true that at death you lose like a half an ounce of weight or something, and some people claim that that's related to the soul leaving the body? Is there any truth to that?
I don't know. That's an interesting thing to talk about. But the point here is that according to Newtonian physics, if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist, right? So since nobody's ever measured the soul repeatedly, therefore it doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, then it can have no, you know, impact into their therapeutics. So medical doctors believe, or taught to believe, that consciousness is a function of biochemistry. Psychiatrists believe that love and, you know, human emotion are biochemical phenomena, period, and that they exist only as a function of biochemistry. Holistic doctors believe exactly the opposite. We believe that consciousness creates biochemistry. We believe that there is a human soul which exists before birth and which persists after death and which, in fact, manages everything that goes on in the human body. And this is why, in fact, when somebody dies, their body decays. Well, you ever thought about that? Why does that happen? You know, the chemical.
So what you're saying, as soon as the soul or whatever leaves the body and it's no longer animate, that's when decay begins.
Yeah, because it's the soul force inside the body which is keeping everything together. This is our basic position, right? But more to the point, you know, holistic medicine is not categorically metaphysical in its orientation. But being holistic, we take into consideration more than allopaths do. And, you know, I, it's interesting to think about this because the only classification of illnesses that MDs can cure are traumatic, you know, traumatic disease, bullets in the arm, lacerations, burns, fractures of the bone, and infectious disease, things like pneumonia and bronchitis. But for everything else, for most of the conditions that most people go to the doctor for, MD-directed allopathic reductionistic pharmaceutical-centrist medicine only delivers disease management. This is why I hate the term healthcare. Medical doctors do not practice healthcare. They practice disease management.
Well, you know, and really what they should be doing, and we can go into this more later, but they should be, allopaths should be focused on emergency medicine, correct?
They, in a perfect world, they would be, because that's what they excel at.
And, yeah, and that's where they shine over anybody else is emergency medicine. You get in a head-on car accident, you want an allopath, correct?
Yeah, correct. And the stuff that's being accomplished in the surgical theater in the 21st century is phenomenal and awesome. Just this side of miraculous. You know, they're really, really good at it, really, and getting better. But for most of the stuff that most people go to the doctor for, not only are their therapeutics ineffective at creating a cure, but they're also the third leading cause of death in the United States. Let me say that one more time. As reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association, MD-directed medical treatments are the third leading cause of death in the United States, right behind heart disease and cancer.
Okay, so marijuana has killed zero people in written history, and MDs are the number three cause of death, and yet marijuana is illegal and MDs are legal.
Yeah, and I'm a quack, right?
And you're a quack, got it. Okay, so how is allopathy suppression medicine?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's a very interesting thing to think about. You know, like the fella said, from the proper perspective, everything makes sense. So because allopaths are trained in this reductionistic method, which relies almost exclusively on the use of synthetic drugs, when they see a system failure, you know, like high blood pressure or eczema, instead of trying to get to the root cause of what the problem is, they don't do that because they're not holistically oriented, right? They don't look at the entire system and see how all the pieces fit together.
Let me just interject here for a second. You know, we do a lot, and I mentioned this to you yesterday about the trivium and quadrivium and all of that. And when you study the trivium, we call this putting your logic before your grammar. In other words, you're putting your conclusions before your research. You're trying to answer why before you've asked who, what, where, and when.
That's exactly it. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It is exactly it. And if you listen to direct to consumer prescription drug ads closely enough, you kind of hear what they're saying. Nobody ever says that there's a relationship, for instance, between cholesterol and heart disease. They never say that. You assume that because of the way that the ad is structured, but they never come out and say that because it's not true. There's no relationship between cholesterol and heart disease. It does not exist. And, you know, we can talk about that at another time. But the fact of the matter is that because they view the world through this reductionistic lens, when they see somebody with something like eczema, all that they are trained to do is deliver medicines which knock down the inflammation on the skin. And these, of course, are anti-inflammatory medicines. So, you know, they deliver prednisone and the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines because eczema is, you know, has a component of that illness is inflammation. So they knock down the inflammation with drugs, and they knock it down on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. They just keep hammering the body away at the inflammation until the body gets so tired that it stops creating the inflammation.
Now, let me ask you this. If something is bad enough and you have something that you need suppressed, would that be good to have that suppressive type medicine in relation to something positive and strengthening the body at the same time so that the person can deal with the symptom and at the same time be healed? Or do they need to stay away from that altogether?
No. And that's another excellent point, Jan. you know, naturopathic physicians are trained in the application of drugs. And in 16 states, I think, currently in the United States, we have prescriptive rights, you know, for 75% of legend drugs. There is a time when anti-inflammatories and pain medication are effective. But when a naturopathic doctor uses, for instance, an anti-inflammatory medicine, it's to knock down the inflammation so that you can give the person's body a leg up on the illness while you are delivering the curative treatment, right? So we can do both. But MDs, not knowing what we do, can only deliver the anti-inflammatory, the anti-inflammatory, the anti-inflammatory. That's all that they do. Now, a very interesting thing happens. Again, remember, our perspective on disease and illness is holistic. And in as much as it's holistic, it's much more comprehensive than a reductionistic view of disease. This is why reductionists really shine in the surgical theater, because that's the epitome of reductionism. I mean, holy smokes, you're pulling a bullet out of somebody's arm, you're stitching up a bleeding artery. It doesn't get any more reductionistic than that. And that's why they're so good at what they do.
Now, what about if somebody's already in a heart attack and they immediately need a heart bypass surgery or something like that? Is that still in the realm of MD?
Well, we'd have to knock it down to different individual diseases. You know, heart attacks, rarely. Heroic medicine can help people to not die from a heart attack. But heroic medicine will never, ever get to the root cause of what made the heart go bad in the first place.
And by heroic medicine, you're saying allopathic or emergency medicine.
Correct. Now, I'm a giant fan of emergency medicine. And in my perfect world, there would be trauma centers instead of hospitals around the country. And the hospitals would be managed by and populated by holistic practitioners, because we actually help people to recover their health. Medical doctors do not. They manage disease. And in the management of the disease process, they kill thousands of people, according to the United States Department of Health and Human Services. For heaven's sake, Medicare patients, 15,000 Medicare patients a month are maimed, injured, or killed by MD treatments, and we don't bat an eyelash. It's crazy how we have become immune to the egregious treatment failures offered up by the allopaths. Now, you know, this isn't good doctor, bad doctor talk. This is just perspective. You know, you wouldn't take your laptop computer to a plumber to get it fixed, right? You wouldn't do that. That would be silly. So if you're suffering from a chronic disease and you go to an MD, that's a fool's game. If you're having a heart attack, or you're bleeding to death, or you've just had a triple fracture of your leg while you're skiing, you need to go to the MD. That's a smart move. But we don't know these distinctions in the United States, because the only medicine that's practiced in our hospitals, the only medicine that's covered by our insurance, the only medicine that's even legally practiced in most states in the United States is MD-directed pharmaceutical medicine, which is the third leading cause of death and does not work. The reason that we have a healthcare crisis in the United States, the reason that companies are shipping jobs overseas, is because they cannot afford to pay their employees' salaries and their employees' health care. Why can't they afford their employees' health care?
And isn't the United States spending more per employee on health care than any other country in the world?
Almost three times. And for that outrageous expenditure of money in the industrialized nations, we're second from the bottom in the health of our citizens. We spend almost three times as much per person per year on health care. And in the industrialized nations, we are second from the bottom in the health of our citizens. It's unbelievable.
You know, I used to live in Yugoslavia, and I was sick back when I lived there, and I had to go to the hospital a number of times because I had a chronic stomach illness that actually wasn't cured until 2009, when I went to Peru with some information that an ND had given me to give the MDs to help cure me. But the doctors here I found incompetent, so I left the country. And but when I would go to the pharmacies in Yugoslavia, most of the pharmacies would give you a choice of pharmaceutical remedies or herbal remedies. And you had an equal choice in all of these pharmacies, and none was pushed over the others. The pharmacist would tell you what each of them do and what the options are, and it was your choice of which you wanted.
Well, this is why they have better results in other countries around the world than the U.S., because since the 1920s, since the Flexner Report, there's no free market. There has been no free market since the Flexner Report in medicine in the U.S. There has been none. The MDs completely monopolize everything. Everything, they monopolize it. My colleague, Dr. Wallach, who I've been mentoring with for the last 2.5 years, one of the oldest naturopathic physicians in the world and certainly the most experienced, in the 70s was working for Yerkes Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And he discovered, proved, and published that cystic fibrosis, number one, is not a human's only disease, that it can happen in monkeys too. It can cross species lines. And that it's caused by a selenium deficiency in the pregnant mother. That's what causes it. If the pregnant mother doesn't have enough selenium, a certain part of her DNA is damaged. And a chromosomal area is damaged by lack of selenium. And that leads to, that's the genesis of cystic fibrosis. He proved it and published it. And for that gift to humanity, Yerkes Primate Research Center fired him. And every major medical university in the United States blackballed him, because the National Institute of Health called up medical schools and said, if you hire Dr. Wallach, we're pulling all of your funding. Now, why did they do this? Two reasons. Because number one, when you cure something, all the research money dries up. Number two, because the cure in this case was selenium, which is a naturally occurring substance like calcium and magnesium, you can't patent it. You can't patent a naturally occurring substance. You can't go to Washington, D.C. and patent orange juice or buttercups. But you can patent it if it's a synthetic drug. If it's never, if that molecule is man-made, you can patent it, baby. And that's why they do it. Medicine in the United States is not results-driven. It is profits-driven. And that's why we have such horrible treatment outcomes here in the United States. But because the population does not have any perspective on this, when they get sick, when we get sick collectively, we go to the only show in town. Even though that show that we go to has a high probability of hurting us and an even higher probability of not being able to fix the problem. It's like we are a ship of fools. Just because we don't know any better. It's a gigantic problem here.
All right, let's shift gears now and let's go into diet and nutrition. How important is calcium to the diet, and what diseases can occur with a lack of calcium?
147 diseases are caused by a calcium deficiency. 147. If you burn somebody, if someone dies and they're cremated, 1/5 of the ash by mass is calcium. I mean, the body has need of, in order for the human body to be healthy, it needs to have imported into it 91 essential nutrients a day, 91. Of those 91, 60 are minerals, and of the minerals, calcium is hands down the major player. High blood pressure most of the time is a calcium deficiency disease. Vertigo, ringing in the ears, chronic laryngitis, lazy eye, Bell's palsy. These are all calcium deficiency diseases.
Muscle. What about arthritis and things like that?
Yeah, arthritis, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, bad muscle cramps, bad cramps during the menstrual cycle, twitching of muscles anywhere in the body. These are all calcium deficiencies. Now, it's when it comes to arthritis, it's more than just calcium that's deficient, right? And this is an interesting thing to talk about in the world of holistic medicine. There's something that's been going on for the last 30 years in the world of holistic medicine called fractionated nutrition. And it's kind of like a hybridization of holistic medicine and reductionistic medicine. And by and large, it's been driven by people with PhDs who are not trained in the holistic method, and by MDs who become fed up with drug and surgical treatments and want to get their feet wet with holistic medicine. You know, a leopard never changes his spots, So an MD being trained in reductionism, even though he or she may have a good heart and know that their therapeutics are failing and want to try something different, when they get their feet wet with holistic medicine, they start to deliver vitamins and minerals and herbs reductionistically. So, you know, instead of the antibiotic, they'll give Golden Seal. Instead of the antiviral, they'll give intravenous IV vitamin C in massive doses or whatever. And this is called fractionated nutrition, and it's not good because the human body, again, remember, from the holistic point of view, the human body is a complex system of interrelated parts which is endowed with a God-given, or if you're an atheist, with a natural ability to fix itself. And what does the human body need to fix itself? It needs all of the raw materials that it needs to fix itself. It needs 91 essential nutrients, one of which, a giant player in this field, is calcium. But if we just give calcium, we're going to miss the boat. So what do? We give all 91 essential nutrients to everybody, appropriate for their body weight, and if they're suffering from a calcium deficiency, we give extra calcium for 3 or 4 months. And when you do it holistically like this, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, the body recovers in record time. You wouldn't believe the things I've seen people recover from. You wouldn't believe it.
Let's talk about cholesterol. How important is that to the diet?
Well, one of the biggest cultural myths, which is completely driven by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, and I'm an open-minded person, and you know, I'm half on board with half of the conspiracy theories that exist in the world, but I have to tell you, when it comes to cholesterol, it is a drop-dead pharmaceutical conspiracy, this notion.
Well, and Sally Fallon in her documentary film, The Oiling of America, well proves that it's a conspiracy.
Well, there you go. I'm not familiar with that, but you know, all things being equal, it has to be. Because cholesterol, let's think about it this way. Every cell of the human body, trillions of cells, I don't care if it's a skin cell, a liver cell, an eye cell, a nerve cell, I don't care. Every cell in the human body has a membrane. The cell membrane is made from cholesterol. All of the insulation that wraps around all of our nerves is made from cholesterol. 75% of the white matter of the brain is cholesterol. And all of your hormones, whether it's...
So wait a second. Wait a second, Peter. So you're saying that our brains are made of cholesterol?
Yeah, 75% of the white matter of the brain is made from cholesterol. That's what...
Okay. So what happens if you don't have enough cholesterol in your diet then?
Yeah. Well, cholesterol is not an essential nutrient because it is so important to the human body that you can make it. The human body can make cholesterol. And the last point to ponder about cholesterol, all hormones, all sex hormones, all stress hormones are made from cholesterol. It's extremely important. It is so important to the human body that your liver will make it if you don't have enough of it in your diet. So look.
Okay, but how much can the liver make if you don't have enough in your diet?
It can only fulfill about 20% of your body's needs.
Okay, so all of these people on these low-fat diets and things like that, the liver couldn't possibly make up for that.
No, it's nuts, and you have to think about it this way. From our point of view, from my point of view and Dr. Wallach's point of view and a number of my colleagues' point of view, Alzheimer's disease is a physician-created disease. It's risen from obscurity, you know, 50 years ago. It was an obscure illness. To the sixth or fifth leading cause of death now, depending on how you crunch the numbers, Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, so Alzheimer's and other mental diseases like Parkinson's disease and things like that, you think are related to Lipitor and other statin drugs?
Yeah, and here's how it works, right? So cholesterol is an extremely important nutrient. So medical doctors have wrongly told you that cholesterol is related to heart disease. It is not. So for the last 40 years, everybody in this country has been on cholesterol-lowering statin drugs to the tune of $15 billion a year in sales. $15 billion with a B, dollars a year in statin drug sales, fat-free diets, and exercise, right? While we've been fat-phobic and cholesterol and statin drug crazy for the last 40 years, heart disease has remained the number one killer. It has not changed at all. Meanwhile, Alzheimer's has risen from obscurity. All of a sudden, erectile dysfunction is a big deal. Women are getting hot flushes for 5 years instead of for 2 months. And Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis are increasing at record rates. Why is this? Because when you drive cholesterol into the ditch with fat-free diets and statin drugs, your body becomes cholesterol deficient. And when you're cholesterol deficient, some people, your brain dries up. You get Alzheimer's. When other people, their cholesterol dries up and their body doesn't have enough raw materials to make sex hormones. So in men, you can't make enough testosterone. In women, you can't make enough progesterone. So women get hot flushes and men get erectile dysfunction. It's nuts.
So you get mental disorders and things like that. Okay, so let me put this into a historical context. Okay, so it is claimed that Hitler was a vegetarian, which would mean that he might not have been getting enough cholesterol in his diet. His liver couldn't make up the difference. And so we have this psychotic world leader who kills millions of people.
Well, my colleague, Dr. Wallach, did a very interesting. He wrote a book called Rare Earths, Forbidden Cures. And the book talks a lot about the body's need for minerals. And there were some very interesting studies done with children that had, you know, pretty strong behavioral disorders, you know, wild children. And they did before and after pictures and before and after psychological studies when the kids were minerally deficient and then when the kids were put on mineral supplements. And when they were completely mineralized, they were little angels. And when they didn't have enough minerals in their body, they became monsters. Now, there are a number of factors that can lead to mental imbalances. Not enough cholesterol, not enough of the B vitamins, B like baby, not enough minerals. Too much of, you know, foods that are high in free radical content, too many fried foods, too much sugar in the body. There are all of these things which are impacting the system from all of these different angles all of the time, which will then lead to a facultative breakdown somewhere in the body. So, you know, it's not just a cholesterol thing, but that's a big player. It's not just a calcium thing, but that's a big player. And remember, we're holistic. So from our point of view, what do we do? Well, we believe that the human body can fix itself if it has all of the raw materials that it needs to do that, and if you're not unwittingly eating all of the wrong foods all the time. So we clean the diet up, make sure there's salt and cholesterol and good fats in the diet. We give the body all the 91 essential nutrients and good recipes appropriate for the body weight. And voila, the arthritis goes away. The type 2 diabetes goes away. The high blood pressure goes away. And granddaddy starts to remember his kids' names again. And it's unbelievable what the human body will bounce back from if you give it a break.
All right, Peter. Let's go into homeopathy. What is homeopathy and how does it work?
One of the most misunderstood systems of medicine in the world. Homeopathic medicine is based on five theoretical laws, five laws. And the one that people focus on is the law of potentization. But, and we'll talk about that in a second. But basically, in a nutshell, homeopathy believes that when the human body is sick, suffering with an illness, one of the reasons that it is expressing symptoms, you know, like eczema or high blood pressure or pain, is because the system has been destabilized and knocked off balance by some external stress, like a virus or a bacteria or a fight with your wife or bad weather or bad food or whatever. External stress impacts the system, destabilizes the system. The system goes off balance, and as it goes off balance, it generates symptoms. Now, a homeopath argues that in order to help the body recover its balance so that the symptoms go away and stop expressing themselves, you need to give the body, give to a sick person medicine which, when given to a healthy person, created exactly the same illness. This is why it's called homeopathy, right? Homeo refers to as similar to, pathos, the disease. So if you were to come to me with a migraine headache, which felt like someone was squeezing your temples between a vise, And it was made much worse by the application of, by a cold application, you know, like a cold compress applied to your head. And I'm a homeopath. I would search through my homeopathic database until I found a medicine which produced in a healthy person the symptom that their head was being squeezed between a vise and was, and the pain was made much, much worse by a cold application. And when I then deliver that medicine to the person with the headache, the illness cancels itself and disappears. And this happens through the action of a theoretical function called the law of similars. It's somewhat akin to vaccination, but not really. In any event, the law of similars argues that when you give the body a medicine which produces exactly the same symptoms in a healthy person that the sick person is suffering from, it will bring the system back into a state of homeostasis and the illness will disappear. And that, in a nutshell, is homeopathy. And that, and talk about diametrically opposed to drug therapy. You know, medical doctors are taught that the human body doesn't have the ability to fix itself and you must march in and control the metabolism of the body with synthetic prescription drugs that need to be taken over and over and over. MD-directed allopathic reductionistic medicine is like communism, because communists believe that every aspect of the society has to be controlled. Well, medical doctors believe
or,
the same
or thing. Fascist communists or fascist capitalists believe that as well, too, if you ever study the Capper reports.
Well, so it's, you know, homeopathy is, you know, more democratic. That's not a good word. But when we give the body a medicine which pushes it in the same direction that the illness is pushing it, the body will recover by virtue of something called the law of similars. And, you know, it's out of...
What are those five laws?
Well, there is the law of similars, Herring's law of cure, the law of potentization, which is where everybody gets stuck, really. And there are two others that I can't think of off the top of my head.
The law of single remedy and the law of miasms.
Very, very good. The law of the single remedy and the law of miasms. Yeah, but when people think about homeopathy, at least when it's criticized in mainstream media, you know, it's criticized by because of the law of potentization. Because when you develop a homeopathic medicine, it is diluted so much. It's diluted beyond Avogadro's number, which means that the medicine that you are giving the sick person has been diluted so much from the original raw material that the medicine was made from that the chance of even one atom, one molecule of the original substance being existing in the medicine is infinite. It's extremely dilute, and this is where, like acupuncture, holistic medicine walks into the metaphysical side, because you cannot measure with current technology what's going on with the homeopathic medicine, but we can see that it produces results over and over. But medical doctors, because they can't measure anything, therefore assume that it's all placebo.
Yeah, and then from there they call it a homeopathic quackery and things like that. So what needs to be done to get the grammar, to get the research on that specific topic so that that base is covered and homeopaths are no longer attacked for that?
A tsunami needs to hit the East Coast. Everybody, the civilization needs to be wiped out, and the you know, monetary base of the country needs to be broken down to a still point.
But on a scientific level, what could we do to try and figure that out?
There needs to be objective experimentation that's done to prove that. And it will be best done in animals, right?
And really what they need to do is compare these things to placebos and seeing it and find out if they're working better than placebos in controlled studies and things like that, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. But, you know, these things are never going to be published in mainstream medical journals, at least in the United States, because the journal industry in the United States has been co-opted by Big Pharma.
Oh, well, it's been co-opted in England and the rest of the world, too. And in fact, I noticed in your book you cite Dr. Richard Horton, at the Lancet. Are you aware that Dr. Horton has charges against him right now for academic fraud that were filed against him by Dr. Andrew Wakefield?
Well, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. It is one big incestuous money pit, and it's a problem, you know, because we're suffering here in the United States. All over the world, people suffer from illnesses that are easy to fix. And because medicine is monopolized by the MDs, the only people we have access to when we're sick and scared are the MDs, and we're scared. We don't know what else to do. And so they have us by the you-know-what, and this is the only reason that their therapeutics persist. They've out-legislated, the MDs have out-legislated everybody else. They've completely monopolized the money market, and they have us all at their beck and call, and it's a giant problem. But this is why myself and my colleagues, you know, we give hundreds of free lectures a year all over the country attempting to generate a grassroots movement, a grassroots coalition of the informed, people that actually understand you can heal the body. And there are two myths that we suffer from in this country. Number one, the myth that the MD is king, knows everything that there is to know about medicine, and everybody else is a back-of-the-bus quack. It couldn't be further from the truth. That's a giant myth that we suffer from. The second myth is a bigger myth. We're all suffering from the false notion that healing is complicated and that it's some mysterious process that should only be articulated or managed by people with, you know, big degrees working with stethoscopes around their neck and white coats and multi-million-dollar high-tech facilities. It's nonsense. Healing, it's easier to help your body recover from type 2 diabetes, arthritis, high blood pressure, eczema, psoriasis, kidney stones, liver failure, you name it, than it is to fall off a potato truck. This stuff is easy.
You just named almost every single issue that my stepfather has in that one sentence.
Well, this welcome to the United States of America, right? But because we only have access to MD-directed medicine, everybody in this country is sick. And because everybody is sick, we have been culturally conditioned to believe that that is the way that it is. It must be that way because it's happening to everybody. Well, why is it happening to everybody? Because everybody goes to MDs. Everybody's bet on the wrong horse. That's the only reason why we get sicker the older that we get. It's not aging. It's not the stress of life. It's your body has run out of the stuff it needs to keep itself healthy, and your medical doctor doesn't know this. Gives you drug after drug after drug to manage the problem. And we're like, it's crazy what we've
Band-Aids on top of Band-Aids.
Yeah, that hurt. Band-Aids on top of Band-Aids that hurt. And
yeah.
It's a problem.
Yeah, so, all right, let's go back for a second to homeopathy and...
Yeah.
Let's talk about the book Copeland's Cure by Natalie Robbins. What is that book about?
Copeland's Cure is a fascinating kind of objective history of the rise and fall of the homeopathic medical industry in the United States. Now, and it's a really, for people that are history buffs, you know, for people that really want to know the reason why things are today the way that they are, that's a really good resource because it walks you right through the Flexner Report and all of this other stuff that was going on behind the scenes at the turn of the century that ushered in the rise of the MDs. It's a fantastic, very well written, and it's filled with all this documentation and resources and, you know, and research. It's really great. And it's a really a chilling tell-all about that kind of pulls back the curtain on, you know, everything that we've been talking about here, the monopolization of modern American medicine and the usurpation of Americans' health. It's a problem. You know, there's nothing wrong with making money, folks. You know, I'm a fan of the profit motive. I don't have a problem with it. But when an industry is monopolized, it's a problem. And when a healthcare industry becomes a for-profit industry, that's a problem. And that's what we have. We have a monopolized for-profit healthcare, disease management system here in the United States. It's not healthcare. It's disease management, and it's for profit, and it's killing.
Well, what do they call it again? HMO. Let me see. That was a health maintenance organization.
Yeah, right. It's got nothing to do with health. It should be called DMO, disease management organization, because that's what it is. You got to call a spade a spade. And, you know, language, as you've pointed out, is important. Every time I drive by a hospital and I see a big sign up on the side of that hospital, healthcare, you know, Adventist healthcare. I want to climb up there in the middle of the night with my graffiti, you know, and change it, because it's not healthcare. But the average American doesn't know this, especially if they're over 50. That generation grew up with Marcus Welby and MASH, you know, and they think that the doctor can do no harm. And they don't understand that it's a for-profit monopolistic industry that's killing us. Third leading cause of death, for goodness sake. We're going to hell in a handbasket, and that's why, you know, we give interviews like this, because we're trying to wake people up. It's healing is easy. It's not hard to do this. You can recover from arthritis. You can recover from type 2 diabetes. You can recover from congestive heart failure. It's not difficult. You just don't know how to do it, but we do. And it's easy. I can teach anybody listening to this radio show in 1 hour. I can show you how to help your friends and family and church members and community members recover from most chronic disease. As God is my witness. And that's, you know, what gets me up in the morning. That's why we do what we do, quite frankly.
And did we talk enough about the vital force and what that's all about?
Well, no. The vital force is an interesting concept, and it is a patently holistic concept, right? Holistic doctors believe that the human body is inhabited by a soul force, right? Whatever it is that leaves the body at the moment of death, whatever it is that makes the light go away from the eyes of someone who's alive and then who's dead 10 seconds later, whatever that is, whatever that energy, whatever that force is, we believe it animates the human body and delivers something to the human body called the vital force. And the vital force is what acupuncturists manipulate with their therapeutics. The vital force is what the homeopathic medicines manipulate with their therapeutics. And it's, you know, unmeasurable, at least with our current state of, you know, technology. But it is a very important phenomenon from the holistic point of view, because the vital force is that which causes the human body to self-regulate. You know, when you cut your hand, you don't have to direct your immune system to increase macrophage response time and lay down fibrinogen and you know, initiate healing by second intent. You don't have to do all that. The body does it all by itself. When you eat a sandwich, you don't have to tell your stomach how to digest it and your gallbladder when to secrete bile and your pancreas when to secrete pancreatic acid. You don't have to do that. You just eat the darn sandwich. The body takes care of itself. And, oh, by the way, the human body grew itself all by itself from a single-celled organism into the magnificent creature that we call you and me. That's all done by the vital force, which MDs completely don't believe in. You know, I characterize MDs as colorblind art critics, you know, because they can see that that's a picture of a tree. They can see that, but they're completely blind to the colors and textures that make up the heart of the art. And because they're blind, but they don't know it, their therapeutics must therefore be jaded, and in fact they are, which is why they're the third leading cause of death, and they can't cure a darn thing. End of story.
Let's talk about psychiatry. What is their issue, in your opinion?
Well, psychiatrists are the worst of the worst, because psychiatrists believe that consciousness is a function of biochemistry, right? You know, that's how ecstasy came into being, you know, the street drug ecstasy.
It was invented, I think, by Alexander Shulgin, who I know.
Yeah, that's correct. It was invented to help couples have better intimacy, you know, married couples who are having intimacy problems. Ecstasy was invented in order to biochemically assist the intimacy. So, you know, psychiatrists believe or because psychiatrists observe that you can alter somebody's way of being, you can alter somebody's psychological state through the administration of drugs.
What about something like LSD that dramatically affects consciousness?
Yes. They, because they're colorblind, they therefore assume that, well, and it's like that, you know, that logical progression that you were talking about, putting the facts ahead of, you know.
Right. Logic before grammar.
Yeah. They falsely assume that because drugs can affect consciousness, therefore consciousness is caused by drugs. That consciousness is a function of biochemistry. And we believe that biochemistry is a function of consciousness. They're two completely separate and distinct. They couldn't be further from the truth.
And that's interesting that you say that because, you know, and I'm an ethnobotanist. And, you know, last year there was MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, put on a huge conference up in San Jose. And all of the leading researchers, Alexander Shulgin, Dave Nichols, all of these guys were there. And they lay everything out and all of their research. And then they'll admit that they have no idea how this stuff works.
Well, the yogis, it's interesting to make note that the authentic yogis, I mean the real deal, you know, the real Siddha yogis, refer to LSD as the yogi drug. Because from my way of understanding it, what LSD and hallucinogenic mushrooms and, you know, other botanical medicines, peyote and other hallucinogens that are used by indigenous people around the world, the way that they work is by facilitating tuning into a different frequency of consciousness. You know, you change your channel.
I would agree with that. And interestingly, all of these substances are crystalline in form. And of course, crystals do have that sort of effect. And that's something that I've very often considered myself. And although I should point out that the word hallucinogen is inapplicable anymore, except for ayahuasca. Nobody believes that they cause hallucinations anymore. They believe that they mostly pull up suppressed thoughts and things from our childhood and traumatic experiences and things like that.
That's fascinating, really. That's a fascinating medicine, ayahuasca. But more to the point, right? Here's what if we're going to kind of keep this in perspective and, you know, try to keep it grounded, because metaphysical stuff, even though it is in that immeasurable zone, is real. And, you know, it affects everything that happens in our life. But the problem, the inherent built-in problem with most metaphysical phenomena, you know, is that it is a patently personal experience. For instance, you could be a meditator and one afternoon have a breakthrough where you experience cosmic consciousness. And, you know, you rise above your body, you have an out-of-the-body experience, and you have a completely authentic, valid experience of another dimension of reality. And then come back into your body, and you would not be able to prove to anybody that that had happened.
You know, I can't tell you, Peter, how much you just hit the nail on the head with that one, because, you know, being an ethnobotanist, I can't claim to never having tried these things and never having had out-of-body experiences. And that's the exact issue, is when you come back from these experiences, trying to explain to other people what just happened. And of course, the reductionists don't believe that it's possible. But then what they're doing is they're putting their logic before their grammar. They need to have that personal experience themselves. They need to go eat the mushrooms and sit on a pillow or take the ayahuasca or peyote or meditate or whatever and have that type of experience and then look at it from that angle. But now, thankfully, due to Dr. Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins University, at least now they're admitting that this stuff is real and it does create real religious experiences.
And, you know, the TM people were... I'm not a big fan of that movement, but nonetheless, one of the things that they did contribute was they did some very interesting
What is the TM?
Transcendental Meditation.
Okay, got it.
Right? Yogi Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, that guy, you know, the Beatles guru, right?
Right, okay.
They did a lot of very interesting sociological studies where they would send, you know, 100 TM people into a neighborhood, and they'd all live in the same building, and they'd start meditating. And the crime rates in the neighborhood came down. And the only thing that had changed was these people had moved into the neighborhood and started meditating. That was the only variable. And they did this a number of times. So, you know, there are ways to kind of get around, you know, to parenthetically, tangentially measure some of these effects. But the thing I like to talk about the most in this regard is love, right? So here's a fun experiment. Here's a great way to kind of put it back on a reductionist or someone who's just, you know, extremely conservative in their worldview. So, and this will blow people's minds. So all that you need to do when you come up against somebody who's pigheaded like this is ask them whether or not they love their mother. You know, Ronald Reagan, do you love your mother? Well, yes, I do. Oh, well, thank you very much, Mr. Reagan. Can you prove it? I want you to prove that you love your mother. Well, they can't, because you cannot prove love. Why? Because love is a patently metaphysical experience, right? And, you know, arguably one of the most moving forces in the world, love, is unprovable. But psychiatrists, you know, to complete this part of the discussion, believe that love is a function of biochemistry because they can alter the way that people feel with drugs. It's crazy. So, you know, we have a completely convoluted way of looking at all this stuff. And even though people will tell you that they patently don't believe in anything that can't be measured, in the same breath, they'll tell you that they love their mother. And they're hypocritical when they do that because you can't do both.
All right, Peter, how is it possible to create type 2 diabetes in mice?
Oh, you just withdraw certain minerals from the mouse's diet. You do the same thing in humans. Type 2 diabetes is a mineral deficiency disease. It is not genetic, and it is not a curse of God, and it's not caused by aging. It's a simple mineral deficiency, the same way that iron deficient anemia, you know, is an iron deficiency, or rickets is a vitamin D deficiency. Scurvy, you know, if you're a pirate, it's a vitamin C deficiency. Well, type 2 diabetes is a multiple mineral deficiency. And a doctor named Walter Mers in 1954 discovered that if he removed chromium from the diet of laboratory mice, they all got type 2 diabetes. And when he put chromium back, guess what? The type 2 diabetes went away. Type 2 diabetes is one of the easiest conditions to fix. And even though we have had thousands of people all around the country with a definitive diagnosis of type 2 diabetes before they come and see us, follow our advice with diet and nutritional supplements, and the type 2 diabetes disappears, we cannot say that we can cure it. Because, and the same thing with asthma and congestive heart failure and cardiomyopathy heart attacks and arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis and high blood pressure. We've had thousands of people all around the world recover from these illnesses, but we can't say we can cure it because according to the FDA, the only thing that can cure anything is a drug. And if we go around the country saying we can cure type 2 diabetes, they're going to lock us up.
But at the same time, the allopaths have really cured nothing in the last 90 years.
And at the same time, off-label prescription drug use, depending on, and it's a very difficult thing to track with numbers, but the conservative numbers are 20% of prescriptions made by doctors are for off-label use, and the liberal estimates are 60%. Of prescription. This means doctors prescribe drugs for conditions that those drugs are not approved by the FDA to treat. So they will give somebody an antidepressant for their blood pressure, or they will give somebody an anti-anxiety medicine to help them sleep, or whatever. Off-label drug use, drug prescribing is rampant in the allopathic medical community, and it's completely hypocritical. Because in one breath, they'll tell you, oh, all of that vitamin stuff is not backed up by good science. And then they do an off-label prescription. It's completely hypocritical. And also this false notion that vitamin therapy and herbal therapy and holistic medicine is unresearched and not science-based is hooey. It's more researched often than prescription drug uses. Everything that I do is science-based and clinically verified. Everything that I do, let me say that one more time. Everything that I do is science-based and clinically verified, period. And type 2 diabetes is a perfect example of this. If you're listening to this radio show, folks, and you're suffering from type 2 diabetes, you need to fire your doctor immediately because he doesn't know what the heck he's doing and he is endangering your life.
Well, you know, my stepfather, going back to him again, he had open heart surgery last year, double or triple bypass. He's got diabetes. He's got Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or something. They're not sure. They cut one pill out of his regimen, and suddenly half of his symptoms cleared up. Surprise, surprise. And, you know, they've got him on all of these statin drugs and everything else. And so that leads me into the next thing here, which is probably the single most upsetting concept for listeners of my show to understand. And I had Daniela Martin on last week or a couple of weeks ago, who talks about entomophagy, which is eating insects and the quality of foods and nutrition that are in insects, which 80% of the world eats insects. And that is strictly a cultural phenomenon that we don't in our country. And, you know, so with that, and also before, and I mentioned to you on the phone during the week that I had had Sally Fallon on my show a couple of times in the past to discuss meats and things like that. So are meat, lard, butter, eggs, etc. bad for you?
No, they're fabulous. Butter and lard and eggs are some of the most important foods you can eat, as is salt. And here's a news flash. Some of the worst foods that you can eat are whole grains. Wheat, barley, rye, and oats are some of four of the worst foods anybody can eat because the proteins in those foods, and in wheat, barley, and rye, it's called gluten. The protein of oatmeal is not gluten, but it's a protein nonetheless. The proteins in those grains are almost impossible for the stomach to digest. And so when you eat those grains, you get all of these large, architecturally, you know, complicated protein structures tumbling through your small intestine where there should only be small individual amino acids, because it's your stomach's job to chop those proteins up into their constituent amino acids. You can absorb an amino acid. It's an essential nutrient. But you can absorb an undigested protein. So when you've got these big undigested wheat, barley, rye, and oatmeal proteins tumbling through your intestinal tract, they destroy the tissue in the intestinal tract called villi, which absorb nutrients. This is what killed Michael Jackson, his nutritionist. Because they told him to eat your whole grains, Michael. You know, he couldn't absorb squat. That's why they had to inject pain medicine into him, because he couldn't absorb oral pain medicine. Why? Because he'd been eating whole grains his entire life, and it completely destroyed the intestinal milieu, which is responsible for absorbing nutrients. So we've got it all backwards here. It's all backwards, you know. So here's what happens. The human body, I want you to visualize an orange juice bottle. And if that orange juice bottle is full to the top, it's a clear orange juice bottle, right? And if it's full to the top, that represents all of the nutrition that the human body needs every day. I want you to visualize that orange juice bottle as two-thirds empty, one-third full. Most of us in this country are running on fumes. We are two-thirds down in our nutrient reserve. So we're two-thirds of the way out of luck. And then we eat foods for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which destroy the tissue in the intestinal tract that the body uses to absorb nutrients. And then we exercise. And when we exercise, we increase our metabolic rate and we sweat out nutrients. So the more you exercise, the more you accelerate your nutrient loss. And then you eat your whole grain bagel and your oatmeal and your, you know, pizza and your cookies and your crackers and your pie crust and everything else that we eat that has wheat, barley, rye, or oats in it. Drink your beer. And we all get sick because those nutritional deficiencies that are predominant to begin with are driven into the gutter through the stress of life, and then something breaks. So we get type 2 diabetes or arthritis or high blood pressure. And then what do? We go to our MD, who gives us a drug to manage the problem. And that's why everybody is sick, because we're putting the wrong fuel into the tank every day and we don't know it, and we're completely undernutrified. We're all running on fumes, putting diesel fuel into an unleaded engine, and we wonder why we're sick.
Now, let me ask you this. Is, And stepping back for a moment, in the early 90s, myself and Jack Herr and a number of people, Jack Herr was the father of the hemp movement, we used to go around and do lectures at universities and college campuses and things like that regarding EFAs, essential fatty acids, omega-3, 6, and 9, gamma-linolenic, gamma-linoleic, all of that good stuff. And, you know, this is one thing that I patently disagreed, or probably the only thing that I patently disagreed with Sally Fallon on with her Nourishing Traditions, is that she says that all seed oils are bad. But I disagree with her that hemp oil, flaxseed oil, primrose, these types of oils are essential and are very good for you. And in fact, humankind, having a 10,000 plus year history with hemp, we had always used hemp seed as a regular food. Now, would you agree or disagree that hemp and flaxseed and these oils are good or bad for you?
It's irrelevant whether I agree or disagree because it's an academic fact that they are. 2 plus 2 is 4. It's not 5. If I go around saying 2 plus 2 is 5, I'm wrong. If anybody says that hemp oil or flax oil or even primrose oil is a bad food, they're wrong. There are 3 essential fatty acids that the human body needs every day, omega-3, omega-6, and omega-9. I don't care where you get them from. I think hemp oil is hemp. The hemp plant is one of the best places to get omega-3, 6, and 9 because when you extract omega-3, 6, and 9 from the hemp plant, it is in almost the perfect ratio.
And that's exactly what we've been teaching people for 20 years. You know, that our group, Jack Herr and our group, are the ones that got hemp oil into the stores for this very reason.
Well, I did not know that, but that makes you the smartest man in class. And you know, this is the thing about everything, man. This is not some airy fairy, you know, metaphysical, speculative, theoretical thing that we're talking about. This is science. This is biochemistry. This is straight anatomy and straight physiology and biochemistry, right? There are 91 essential nutrients that the human body needs, 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 3 essential fatty acids, 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, and 3 essential fatty acids. We need them every day, and it is impossible to get them just from eating food. You cannot do it unless you're supplementing your diet with the 91 essential nutrients. It's just a matter of time until your deficiencies catch up with you and something breaks. And, you know, the problem with oil, is, as far as I'm concerned, is how it's bottled. You know, because,
right. Well, yeah, but they pour Drano through it. They twist the shape of the molecule and everything. It's absolutely hideous what they do to these Wesson oils and canola oils and all of that crap. I mean, you know, why would anybody ever put that stuff in your body? I mean, seriously, go out, buy some butter. If you have to fry something, use coconut oil or bacon grease or lard or something.
Now, here's an interesting statistic, right? If you look at a map of the United States, and you know where the Mason-Dixon line is, a little bit north of Washington, D.C., if you, from the Mason-Dixon line south, through all the old Confederate states into Florida, that part of the country, people die much earlier than anywhere else in the country. The people in that part of the country have the shortest lifespans of anybody in the U.S. Why is this?
I never heard that before, but please enlighten us.
Well, I don't know if you've ever been to the South. I have a number of times.
Never. Well, no, wait. Once I went to Kentucky when I was 3.
In the South, they fry everything. They fry water if they could, and they admit it. I mean, they fry everything. Now, when you fry a food, when you superheat an oil and then throw a protein or a carbohydrate in it, a chemical is created called acrylamide, and if it's a meat protein, it's called a heterocyclic amine. Acrylamides and its heterocyclic amines are carcinogenic, and they will kill you. Europe, you mark my words, in the next 2 years, by 2013, I think it's Scandinavia, don't quote me on that, but a couple of European countries are going to put warning labels on fried food the same way we put them on cigarettes because of the acrylamide. If you did nothing other than stop eating fried food, you'd add 10 years to your life because that stuff will kill you because of the acrylamide and the heterocyclic amines. So, you know.
Now, cooking things in bacon grease, lard, stuff like that, does it help reduce any of that?
Yeah, none of that's created because you can't get that stuff hot enough to make that happen.
Interesting. Very interesting. So all of these people using these vegetable oils, you know, and back in the 80s, which is, this is why Sally Fallon's work is so important to nourishing traditions and her DVD, The Oiling of America. She shows that in the early 80s, what they did, all the fast food restaurants, they went through and they removed all of the tallow from making French fries and stuff like that, and they replaced it all with toxic vegetable oils.
Crazy. Yeah, and that's what's killing us, you know?
Exactly. And so, you know, in the 80s and before then, French fries weren't nearly as bad for you and detrimental to you as they are today. And then what they did further, and going back to this conspiracy thing that we talked about earlier, is they targeted the Latino community, especially the Mexican community, who uses a very high amount of lard, manteca, and stuff like this to fry their foods with, and they got them all to switch to quote-unquote healthy vegetable oils.
And then accelerated the occurrence of type 2 diabetes in the Latino.
Diabetes and obesity and everything that is now rampant in the Latino community, which back when they were using lard and manteca, it was almost non-existent, right?
Yeah, and it's crazy because we eat all the wrong things all the time. And we're completely undernutrified all of the time. And when we get sick, we use a synthetic drug to manage the problem. And, you know, who do we get advice about food from? Our MD, who has no training, no clinical experience, not even any appreciation for real fundamental nutrition.
So you had, what, 159 hours of nutritional training, and the average MD has, what, 5?
Yeah, and it's elective courses. You know, most of the guys that I know had 0.
I mean,
none of it's mandatory.
All right. So let's get back to Dr. Wallach's research. What did he discover?
Oh, a number of things. I mean, he's a...
What was his big veterinary research discovery? He is a DVM as well as an ND, right?
Yeah, he was the leading research veterinarian pathologist in the world. And after the Minamata disaster in Japan in the 70s, you know, there was an industrial plant in Japan that dumped a lot of mercury into Minamata River. And all that mercury flowed downstream, emptied into Minamata Bay. All the algae sucked it up. The fish ate the algae, and the villagers ate the fish. And everybody got mercury poisoning. Many people died. And 9 months, everybody got sick. Many people died. And 9 months later, all the kids that were born were like Frankenstein. You know, they had like 3 arms, 1 eye, half a brain. It was bad, man. And it was a potential human extinction event. Because the scientific community figured out pretty quickly, well, holy smokes, it was mercury that did it. Well, if mercury could do this, what about, you know, PCBs and chlorofluorohydrocarbons and all of this other crap that we're pumping into the environment in massive doses? So they freaked out. And they put together with the National Institute of Health and Yerkes Primate Research Center and a bunch of places around the country, chipped in money to do a scientific study to figure it out. And who did they tap to lead the study? They tapped Dr. Wallach because he had more experience with toxic pathophysiology in the animal kingdom than anybody else. So what did they do? It was a brilliant experiment. It took 12 years. They did 26,000 autopsies, 26,000 autopsies and over 10 million blood chemistries and histopathologies. So they compared the health of animals in zoos in the United States in urban areas, you know, like the New York Zoo, the Los Angeles Zoo, the St. Louis Zoo. They compared their health to their counterparts in the wild. The idea being that the animals living in urban zoos were exposed to the same crap that we are. It was a brilliant study, which almost was canceled because halfway through the study, they determined that, you know what, and I bet you didn't see this coming, but here's what they determined, that normal,
I read your book.
Normal day-to-day exposure to toxic stuff was irrelevant as far as health was concerned, and that biological systems could handle normal day-to-day exposure. They could handle it.
So how much do people need to worry about the pollution in the meat, the fruits, vegetables, water, air, etc.?
Little bit. You need to worry about that, and it's always better to eat organic, but you don't. But what you need to worry about that just a little bit.
So if you can't get organic food, it's still okay to go around and buy the Whole Foods around the outside of the grocery store. Just stay out of the crap in the middle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And even if, you know, you need to buy because you're poor, even if you need to buy food that's got some preservatives in it, that's okay. Because the only time that stuff like that causes a physiological net negative result is if it's a massive exposure, like what happened in Minamata or Chernobyl, you know, or Three Mile Island. If it's a massive exposure, then it's a problem. But normal day-to-day stuff we can handle. But what they discovered parenthetically, accidentally, while they were doing this research, was that even though there were few negative things, physiological events that happened from pollution exposure, there were massive, massive net negative health effects across species lines from lack of nutrition. It was a big deal. So this research resulted in the publication of a book that's in the Smithsonian Institute now. It's called The Diseases of Exotic Animals. And it revolutionized veterinarian medicine. After this research came out, the lifespan of dogs tripled in the United States. All of a sudden, pandas and lions and tigers in captivity were living way beyond their years and reproducing, right? And they eliminated 900 chronic diseases in animals. Nine of things like you don't see a chicken or a pig or a goat or a cow with arthritis or with congestive heart failure or with type 2 diabetes. They don't get them. Why? Because they figured out the nutritional basis of all these illnesses, and they completely eliminated 900 diseases in the animal kingdom. So Wallach thought to himself, son of a gun, these illnesses cross species lines. These nutrient deficiency diseases cross species lines. They must happen in humans. So he became a naturopathic physician and started applying with humans the same stuff he found with this massive amount of research with animals. And evoked remarkable resolutions of health problems. You know, I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I was very good at what I did. I still am. You know, I've done everything, man. I've done bioidentical hormones. I was one of the first physicians in the country to do that. I've done intravenous chelation. I've done heavy metal detoxification. I've done narrow reference range of fractionated nutrition. I've done homeopathy, dyed-in-the-wool classical homeopath. I've done a lot of holistic therapeutics and have a lot of experience with it and got good results. But since I've been following Dr. Wallach's clinical lead, you know, using his research and his knowledge base and his therapeutics, I don't even know what planet I'm on. Because I've never seen somebody recover from type 2 diabetes in 2 weeks before I met Dr. Wallach, but I see it now. I've never seen somebody recover. I've had patients with fake knees grow cartilage over the fake knee. The things that I'm seeing people recover from are blowing my clinical mind, because when you give the body the stuff that it needs and you give it appropriately in good recipes, the ability of the body to fix itself is phenomenally unbelievable. So in the world of holistic medicine, an unheralded superstar who really needs to be lauded for everything that he's done is Dr. Wallach. And he's, you know, in my mind, he's like the Albert Einstein of the holistic medical movement.
Well, unfortunately, Albert Einstein stole a lot of his quote-unquote discoveries from the U.S. Patent Office, as it's since been revealed. But that's another topic. But speaking of malnutrition, let's discuss vegetarian and vegan diets. What is their issue? Are animal fats absolutely essential for human health? And how can vegetarians and vegans eat healthily?
All right. Well, the fundamental thing here to understand is that there are 91 essential nutrients that the human body needs. And a nutrient is called essential if the human body cannot make it. Cholesterol is necessary for life, but it is not essential because the liver can make it, right?
But only 20%.
But only 20%. That's correct. So we need to consume 91 essential nutrients a day. And it's impossible to get those from food. You just can't do it. So when you are supplementing your diet with the 91 essential nutrients in good recipes that are bioavailable and appropriate for your body weight, when you have done that, it does not matter what you eat.
What about the vegetarian? What about the animal fats and things that people need for their body? How do they get those oils to sustain proper health?
You have to supplement with them. So you know.
But what can you replace the animal fats with? Can you do it just with omega 3, 6, and 9?
Yeah. You can just do hemp oil. That's great.
And that would be enough as long as they were consuming a lot of it to compensate for that.
Yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, it's a question of really the biggest problem with our overall human health is that we are the food that we're eating. I don't care whether you're a vegan or a vegetarian or a carnivore or a lacto-ovo or a fruitarian or whatever you are. The problem is that the food that you are eating does not contain all 91 essential nutrients that you need. It does not. So you have to supplement with them. And when you supplement with them, you can be the healthiest vegetarian on the block. You can be the healthiest carnivore on the block. It doesn't matter. Now, you know, we have identified 9 foods which nobody should even look at, let alone eat. And I don't care if you're a vegetarian or a vegan or a carnivore. If you're not eating these 9 foods and you're supplementing with the 91 essential nutrients, you're good to go. And you've eliminated most of the net negative nutritional stress that you're going to experience in your life. So, you know, you want to be a vegetarian, great. Make sure you take the right supplements. You want to be a carnivore, great. Make sure you take the right supplements and stop eating those 9 foods.
What do you think of Dr. Gary Knoll's work?
Is Knowles the one that did the HIV work?
Yeah, and he's the one that's all over the radio all the time, and he's very heavy in promoting the vegetarian diet. But, you know, I recently heard him say that, you know, most vegetarians should probably at least drink about 3 glasses of milk a day to make up for the lack of fats and calcium and stuff.
Well, you know, here's the thing, that a lot of doctors have half of the story or a third of the story, right? Dr. Wallach is the only one that I've met so far in my career that has all of the story, because it's not just a function of, you know, being a vegetarian or being a lacto-ovo or being a vegan, or it's not a function of making sure that you just eat organic. All of these things, when done properly, will reduce your net negative nutritional stress. But what physicians like him miss is the other piece, which is, well, look, your body needs all the raw materials that it needs in order to work properly every day. And people wrongly assume that you can get all of those from your food, and you can't. You could have a PhD in organic farming. You could own 100 acres in Switzerland. You could grow your own food and eat only the food that you've grown, right? You'd be a complete and total vegetarian. All organic, and you've grown it. It's the best food on the planet, and you'd still be nutritionally deficient. You would still be nutritionally deficient. Your body would not have the stuff that it needs. Now, when you supplement correctly and eat optimally, Superman. And there are cultures around the world that get close to living to mankind's a potential of 120 years. Any geneticist will tell you that the human body has the potential to make it to 120 years. 120 years. We're lucky in this country if we make it to 80. And the last 20 years of our life aren't that pretty, right?
Well, you know, in my family, we do have a high number of... I've got, in the last 4 years, I've had 4 relatives make it over 100.
And how was their health in the last 20 years of their life?
One of them, my Aunt Margaret, she's doing well now. She'll be 104 in December. She's an author. She's written 25 books. She still writes. Her sister Charlotte died at 103. She was still clear in the head, but had lost her eyesight, and there was some other degeneration going on at that point. But, you know, and then their brother died at 100. And all of them, you know, especially Margaret, were fairly healthy, you know, but the biggest issue was my Aunt Charlotte losing her uh, her eyesight was the key issue.
Yeah, it's interesting. See, the people that live in the blue zones, the Okinawans, the Vilcabambas, the Bama people, the Hunza people, of course, arguably the most famous, these cultures around the world, the one out of 250 of them are over 100. And in the United States, it's one out of 10,000. And when they're over 100, they're healthy. You know, I mean, they're walking around.
one out of 10,000, and I've got three or four in my own family. Boy, yeah,
that's pretty good. Yeah, that's very good. You know, but the people in the third world that accomplish this, you know, they don't have health care. They don't have hospitals. They don't have doctors. They don't have insurance. They're lucky if they have a roof over their head. And we have figured out what it is that they do and that they don't do in order to optimize their health. And when,
but they're not taking nutritional supplements.
But they're heating and cooking with wood, and they're putting the wood ash in their food and in their gardens. And wood ash is almost,
that's not in your book.
It's not in my book. It's going to be in my next book. Wood ash is, you know, like 99% plant-derived colloidal minerals. That's what it is. And so when you're putting wood ash into your food, what's called culinary ash, and or wood ash into your garden, the food that you're eating is mineralized. And because they do this, their mineral needs are met. And remember, in that breakdown of the 91 essential nutrients, 60 of the 91 nutrients are minerals. The lion's share of what we need to maintain health are minerals. But the only place that minerals are found is in the soil. Or, you know, sometimes it's in the water, but they've washed out of the soil if they're in the water. And plants can't make minerals. Animals can't make minerals. But minerals are in the soil or not. And mostly, they're not. So everybody who is not supplementing or putting wood ash in their food is minerally deficient. And that's why we're sick and they're not, because they are inadvertently getting a big, healthy dose of plant-derived colloidal minerals every day, and we don't.
Okay, so this new movement of, now I just forgot the term, of the, you know, the uprising and new farming techniques and home farming and all of that, the key issue that they need to do is put the ashes from wood fire into the soil of whatever they're growing.
Yes, or better yet, you know, the Dr. Wallach's company, Youngevity, has exclusive mining rights to a deposit from Jurassic time in southwestern Oregon. And it's 100% plant-derived, organic, colloidal minerals. And in those deposits, when they mine that stuff and, you know, pulverize the rock, it's called humic shale. When they take that stuff out of the ground and pulverize it and let it soak in ultra purified water, all the minerals are extracted. So in one place, we have access to all of the minerals that the human body needs in a colloidal form, which is the preferred absorptive form of a mineral. So when we have farmers all over the world who are buying 55-gallon drums of those plant-derived colloidal minerals and putting them on their fields. And when you grow, and they did a big study in Japan, because it's a small island relatively, and there's only so much space, right? And so they're vying, everybody wants to get as much stuff from their farms as they can. And when they've done studies and compared, you know, the tomatoes that were grown in mineralized soil and the tomatoes that were grown in soil that wasn't mineralized, I mean, the results are, there's no comparison.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, they taste better. They look better. I mean, they have a higher sugar index, when you measure them through objective scientific methods, and it's just better because the plants suck this stuff out of the soil and use them to increase their health, and we need them. So if we do it that way, we're going to be mineralized. But a better way to do it, rather than, you know, doing that, is just to take the plant-derived colloidal minerals and drink them. and that's one of the things that we do is we have these for people. You know, we can get them $19 for a bottle of plant-derived colloidal minerals, and it's a game changer. It's a game changer. And when you do this, when you nutrify your body and stop eating the food that's got acrylamides and heterocyclic amines and gluten in it and a bunch of other things, you're Superman, because your body has everything that it needs. Everything. And it'll be the first time in your life your body has had all the raw materials that it needs. And that's a game changer. And that's why Dr. Wallach's therapeutics produce more results than anything I've ever seen.
Okay, so let me ask you this, you know, because I know that this is going to be a topic that comes up with my audience, because it's an academic audience and they're very well informed on critical thinking and logical fallacies and things like that. So you promote Dr. Wallach's longevity products. Why do you promote those? Do you have any affiliation with that stuff? And is there a conflict of interest there?
No, there's no conflict of interest. I do have an affiliation with Dr. Wallach's longevity company, and there's a reason for it. One of the things that naturopathic physicians do, and chiropractors and medical doctors who are doing holistic medicine, we have access to nutraceutical supplements that you can't get over the counter, right? There's probably 150 vitamin companies in the United States and Europe that sell their products only to physicians. You can't get the stuff if you're a layperson. And so normally what myself and all of my colleagues have done for the last 100 years is we'll have a relationship with one of these companies. And so we buy a bottle of vitamin C from them for, $10, and we'll sell it to our patients for $20, right? It's a normal retail markup. I would only mark my stuff up 80%. So I'd buy a bottle of vitamin C for 10 and I'd sell it for 18. But that's just normal standard, business in the world of holistic medicine.
Right. And being able to keep your lights on and your doors open.
Yeah. Yeah. And so
because you're not getting gigantic kickbacks from doing chemo treatments.
Yeah, that's correct. So, everybody wins and, people get better and life is good. And in the wonderful world of vitamin manufacturing, we could do a whole show about the lack of quality control in the vitamin industry.
Okay.
I mean, it's a big deal.
And okay, when do you want to do that?
Well, I'll look at my calendar. Well, we can do it probably next week.
Okay.
But this was a big thing of mine. This was a big, I have a bee in my bonnet about this particular issue. Because from the person that extracts the vitamin C from whatever they extract it to the actual capsule in the bottle on the shelf at the health food store, there's a big supply chain along the lines of which any number of things can go wrong. And unless the vitamin company is tracking this appropriately, they don't even know what's in the capsule. It's a problem. So there are some companies that do a much better job of this, their quality control, than other companies do, right? So I have tended over the decades to gravitate only towards those companies that can prove to me that what it says it has in the capsule on the label is actually in the capsule. And there have only been three companies that have been able to do that. Only
what
three.
Are they?
Longevity, Vital Nutrients, and Metagenics.
Thank you.
Thorne also did a very good job of quality control.
Okay, good.
But Thorne was just bought by Kikkoman. So I'm not a big fan of Thorne anymore, but that's a personal thing. But my point is, going back to longevity, when I sell a longevity supplement to someone, a patient of mine, I make 8%. That's it. So if I sell a longevity supplement for $100, I make $8. That's a much less of a markup than we normally would make. It's not, normal retail markups, 100%. So 8%, that's a lot less than 100%. But I use longevity exclusively now because their recipes are better than any other nutritional supplement company I've ever seen. They're better. Somebody's got to have the best stuff. Well, they do. And since I've been using the longevity products, I get way better clinical results than I've ever gotten before. And so that's why I'm an advocate of them.
E. Richard Brown's book, Rockefeller Medicine Men, Would you discuss that for a moment?
Yeah, Rockefeller Medicine Man, that goes back to the what we started this whole show with, you know, that since the Flexner Report, it was the Flexner Report that changed the way that medicine is practiced in the United States. It completely unleveled the playing field and gave the MDs the upper hand. Now, let's be common sense about it. If you're starting a business and I'm starting a business and you get $1 million of free money and I don't, who's going to have a more successful business? Well, probably you, because you got $1 million of free money. So after the Flexner Report, everything changed, because the medical schools and the hospitals in the United States that practiced allopathic prescription pharmaceutical centrist medicine got all the money. I mean, they got all of the money. And then they took it a step further, and the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the pharmaceutical companies started to glad hand legislators to pass laws to make it illegal to practice medicine unless you were using drugs. So the chiropractors, you know, became back of the bus. The naturopaths became back of the bus. The homeopaths became back of the bus. The osteopaths even became back of the bus. All because of the Flexner Report and drug money. And E. Richard Brown's book, Rockefeller Medicine Man, walks people through all of this with detail. And it's a startling expose on the fundamental paradigm shift that happened in modern American medicine that created the juggernaut of MD-directed pharmaceutical medicine. And most people in this country are completely unaware of it. Most people wrongly assume that the MDs are in the driver's seat because their therapeutics must be better than everybody else's. But that's not correct. They're the third leading cause of death in the United States, for goodness sake. They're in the driver's seat of medicine because of financial and political coalitions that were built at the turn of the 20th century that everybody's forgotten about. And E. Richard Brown's book, Rockefeller Medicine Man, paints that whole picture. And it should be recommended reading for every, you know, every high school student, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's get into a four-letter word, cure.
Yeah, I wish I could. But, you know, the FDA, according to the FDA, the only thing that can cure anything is a prescription drug. And in order to...
So you're not even allowed to use the word cure.
No, we can't. So we don't say we can cure type 2 diabetes. But what we do say is if you follow our advice, we can support and promote healthy blood sugar levels, and the symptoms of type 2 diabetes will disappear 100%. We can say that.
You know, the only time I have ever heard the word cure being used in medicine and my treatment of being sick for 13 years was after I went to an ND and got a proper diagnosis after 12, almost 13 years of improper diagnosis by MDs. The ND gave me a proper diagnosis. He told me, this is as far as I can take it. You need to go take this information to an MD. So having had all too many years of bad experience with the MDs in this country, and you know, I'm sure you're fully aware of that. I went down to Peru and landed in the hospital down there for a week and was in outpatient treatment for another 2-3 weeks. And what happened was about my third or fourth day in the hospital, after they had been running all these studies on me, doctor comes in and he says, I've got some good news and bad news for you. Which do you want first? I said, the good news. He said, the good news is we've pinpointed exactly what's wrong and I can cure you. And I said, what do you mean you can cure me? Because I've never even heard an MD in the United States use that word. And he says, I mean, I can cure you. Yeah. And I said, well, that's confusing to me because this is the first time I've ever heard a doctor say that. But then he goes on and he says, you know, the bad news was that he didn't expect me to live through that night because I was so far gone at that time. And so they were actually able to, they sent me out to my son's birthday party across the street from the hospital, gave me popsicles and things like that, and being around my son to bring me back up. And then they were actually able to start treatment that night. But that was, you know, the first time I had ever heard that word used by a doctor.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, this is, we've kind of, again, become culturally conditioned along those lines. To not even, you know, question that or think about it. And this couldn't be this particular language phenomenon shows up most egregiously, in my opinion, in cancer treatment, you know.
That was going to be my very next question was, you know, let's talk about cancer treatment and kickbacks and the whole breast cancer issue and that stuff.
Well, we've lost the war on cancer. You know, Richard Nixon's war on cancer, we've lost it. We've pumped about $1 trillion into cancer research. And, you know, 100 years ago, cancer was the number two killer, and today it's the number two killer. There's been we have not leveraged cancer treatment effectively. And there's a publication called The Townsend Letter, which is put together by a group of PhDs who are holistically oriented, and they do a review of literature, you know, along holistic lines. It's called The Townsend Letter. It's a pretty good thing. It's like our New England Journal of Medicine, kind of, you know. And they just completed the part one of a two-part study that looks at cancer treatment in the United States. And they echo what I've been saying for the last 4 years, is that cancer treatment, we've lost the war on cancer. And, you know, there was a study that was published in 1994 in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And they did a 11-year study, I'm sorry. They looked at adults who had developed cancer, adult onset cancer, and were treated with chemotherapy, right? It was an 11-year study. It was an enormous amount of data that they compiled. And they published their results in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And it doesn't get any better than that in allopathic land. And what were their results? Well, strap on your seatbelts. 97% of the time, chemotherapy does not work. Doesn't work. 97% of the time, it does not work. And this was published in 1994. So why is chemotherapy still prescribed?
So you're saying, what I'm hearing you say is that MDs are quacks?
Exactly. Because they are promoting expensive, dangerous therapeutics that don't work.
So why do they call you a quack?
Because it's an upside-down, backwards world.
So what they're really doing is seeing the reflection of themselves and then blaming guys like you.
Yeah, you know, it's like the teenager who gets caught red-handed, and then instead of just, you know,
admitting it,
he lashes out, right? That's what they do. It's infantile, juvenile behavior. And, you know,
complete inability to accept self-responsibility, basically.
Yeah, and even to look at the facts. But there's another component to it, though, which is ka-ching.
So you're saying that there's a vested interest there?
Imagine that.
A conflict of interest? Now, that seems like a conspiracy theory, Peter.
Well, there you go. You know,
or just a conspiracy. Like, I'm not a believer in the conspiracy theory term, because the word theory wasn't added to conspiracy until the 90s.
Yeah, well, isn't language fascinating?
Oh, it's very fascinating.
Isn't it fascinating? I mean, really, look, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and flies like a duck, oh, it's probably a duck. Chemotherapeutic drugs are the only classification of prescriptive agents that the prescribing doctor gets a direct cut from. If you go to an MD and you have a sinus infection, he prescribes, you know, an antibiotic. He gets no kickback from that. Now, if he prescribes 1,000 doses of that antibiotic in 1 month, the company that makes it might send him to Cancun for a conference, quote unquote, right? But that's as far as it goes. With chemotherapy, it's different. So here's how it goes. An oncologist prescribes a cancer patient cisplatin, for instance, which is a chemotherapeutic agent. The hospital buys it from the pharmaceutical company for $3,000. They sell it to the patient for $12,000. Insurance pays $9,000, and the hospital and the doctor split the difference. So with one prescription of cisplatin, you know, the oncologist makes $3,000-$4,000, and that's why they do it. It's the only reason that chemotherapy is prescribed, is because it is a gigantic moneymaker. It is a gigantic moneymaker. And in my opinion, one of the leading worst offenders in the United States about this is the Cancer Treatment Centers of America. They have Cancer Treatment Centers of America have new hospitals popping up all over the country. and they use naturopathic physicians. They actually employ naturopathic doctors at the cancer treatment centers of America, and they advertise that, you know, oh, we have a holistic approach towards health, and we have naturopathic doctors on staff, and giving people the idea that they're doing alternative treatment. Well, they're not. They use the naturopathic physicians to clean up the mess that surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy make, because their primary, secondary, and tertiary lines of attack towards cancer are therapeutics that, like chemotherapy, that don't work. But they're big ticket items. They are big, big, big ticket items. And this is why we have a healthcare crisis in this country, because medicine is a for-profit industry. It is a monopolized for-profit industry. And we're dropping like flies here, going bankrupt, losing our eyesight, losing our mobility, losing our minds, not because we have bad genes.
Literally.
Not because we've been cursed by God, but because we're going to the wrong doctor. It's a tragedy of almost biblical proportions, and when it comes to cancer, it's more than a cry and shame, in my opinion.
What about flu shots and vaccines?
Well, flu shots don't work. You know, the statistics for flu shots are that the most effective they are is 9%. At best, a flu shot provides you with 9% immunity for the flu virus. I mean, those numbers are in.
Have you watched Clint Richardson's documentary film, Lethal Injection, Story of Vaccines? You have watched that.
Yeah. And I think the leading expert, at least in my mind, on this whole vaccine issue is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She's out of Cleveland, Ohio.
Right. I'm familiar with her work.
She's done a lot to, kind of get good information out there. I'm not an advocate of vaccinations. At all. And from my point of view, you know, there's a problem here. And I mean, again, let's be pragmatic. If I was walking through the wilderness, right, and I stumbled and twisted my ankle, well, that's a problem. But if then after I twisted my ankle, a bear mauled me and chopped and bit off my right arm, that's a bigger problem, right? I need to address the lack of an arm before I worry about the sprained ankle. Well, that's, as far as I'm concerned, the whole vaccination thing and the whole pollution thing is like a sprained ankle. And like the chopped off arm is an unrecognized rampant nutrient deficiency. The reason that we're sick in this country and getting sicker, the reason everybody's overweight, the reason that this generation isn't going to live as long as any other generation, the reason that our healthcare costs are skyrocketing is because most of the conditions that most people go to the doctor for are driven by nutrient deficiencies, period. That's the biggest problem that we have in this country. I went and gave a lecture in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, couple of months ago to a gentleman that had recovered from type 2 diabetes down there. And he is very good friends with the director of Medicare in Obama's administration. And they grew up together and they're good friends. And he called him and he talked about what happened to him and his recovery from type 2 diabetes. It took him 4 weeks, I think, for his blood sugars to normalize. His friend, and I can't remember the guy's name, but the director of Medicare in Obama's administration, sat down at his computer and crunched the numbers. And he said, you know what? He said, if 30% of the people in this country who are type 2 diabetic could eliminate their type 2 diabetes the way that you did, we could balance the federal budget.
Wow.
One third.
Well, and then you got to get into the CAFR reports and how that's all another fraud. But that's an entirely different discussion that is not for this interview. Let me ask you this, or let's reiterate again. Where is allopathic medicine good? Where does it shine? And when should people see an MD? And so just so people are clear on that.
All right. So if you have an infection, if you have pneumonia or bronchitis or an infection that has gotten the best of you that you're not recovering from, go to an MD. If you have trauma, You know, you're in an automobile accident, you slice your hand, you get a third degree burn, you're skiing and you break a bone, fall and hit your head, go to an MD. If you have a nasty parasitic infection because you were traveling in a third world country, go to an MD. But that's it. For those conditions, you want to see MDs because that's what they're effective at. For everything else, for all chronic illness, and by all I mean all, things like high blood pressure, you know, fibromyalgia, arthritis, osteoporosis, osteopenia, eczema, psoriasis, heartburn, chronic
diabetes,
type 2 diabetes, chronic low back pain, anxiety and panic attacks, depression, underactive thyroid, overactive thyroid, kidney stones, you know, everything else, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, irritable bowel, gallstones, you know, you name it. For all chronic condition, if you go to an MD, the chances are that the therapeutics that you are delivered will hurt you, and it is guaranteed that the therapeutics that they deliver will not cure the disease. So for those conditions, quite frankly, you don't even need to go to a naturopathic doctor or a holistic doctor. Because another myth that we suffer from in this country is the myth that healing is complicated. It's not.
And your goal is to teach everyone how to heal themselves. But doesn't that take an agenda away from you for you to be able to make a living?
No, because Dr. Wallach set Youngevity up as a networked business with the potential of having a networked business, right? So there's less than 5,000 naturopathic physicians in the whole country. And of those 5,000, there's less than 100 that have more than 20 years of clinical experience, and I'm one of them. You know, and there's 300 and something million people in this country. There's 100 of us. We can't handle all that. And because healing is easy, and it really is, we are developing a grassroots coalition of the informed. So find a Youngevity representative. You know, we've got them in every state in the United States practically, or, you know, get in touch with me. And I will show you how you can become a member of Youngevity. And it's a $10 membership fee, 10 bucks, one time only. And we will teach you for free Dr. Wallach's health recovery methods. And then you can turn your friends and family and church members and community members onto this, because healing is easy. And we're suffering in this country for lack of knowledge. And we need to fix this. And how are we going to fix it? We're going to build a grassroots coalition of the informed. And that's how we do it. Now, you know, if you want a private consultation with me, great. Call me up. You know, I treat people all over the world through the internet and through the phone. And if I can't help you and you want a private consultation, I can find one of my colleagues who I trust that can. But as God is my witness, for most things, you don't even need to do that. Because healing is easy, and we can show you how to do it. And better than that, we can show you how to spread this message effectively so that people will listen. Because the front door of medicine is guarded by the pharmaceutical industry. It is guarded by the pharmaceutical industry. We cannot get this information of health recovery through medical nutrition through the front door. We have to get it through the back door. And we're going to do that by building a grassroots coalition. I hope that you join us. I hope that you get in touch with us and find out. Because really, you know what they say, you don't know what you don't know, right? Well, when it comes to health and healing, what you don't know, will kill you or heal you. And, you know, I'm happy to help. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning.
What is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
It's impossible to maintain your health by eating from the four food groups. You cannot do it. It's impossible. It's not just improbable or unlikely. It's impossible. In order to have a healthy body, you have to supplement appropriately. You have to do it. You know, you have to live in a house. You have to have heating. You have to bathe yourself and use soap, and you have to drink water every day and breathe oxygen every day. You have to do these things or you will die. But one of the other things that you have to do is supplement your diet with the 91 essential nutrients. That is mandatory. If you do not do that, it is only a matter of time before your nutrient deficiencies get so low that something breaks. And in order to avoid that, and in order to help yourself recover, even once it has broken, All you have to do is trust your body's ability to fix itself and give the body the support that it needs. Stop eating the food that's gumming up the works. Get the heck out of the way. Hallelujah, and pass the hat. Your body will fix itself.
And would you please provide the title of your book again and your website and any contact information that you would like people to have?
Yeah, you bet. The title of my book is The MD Emperor Has No Clothes. The MD Emperor Has No Clothes. And my website is easy. It's drglidden.com. You can either spell that D-O-C-T-O-R or D-R. And my last name is Glidden, just like the paint, no relation, GLIDDEN.com. That's drglidden.com. And the title of my book, The MD Emperor Has No Clothes.
Fantastic interview, Peter, and I really appreciate you taking this time. And boy, we drove it all the way up to the 2-hour mark today, and I really appreciate you taking the time and doing such a thorough interview. And I know that this is going to be upsetting for a lot of people, but they need to hear it.
Well, you know, you're welcome. And I want to thank you for the forum. You know, because like Benjamin Franklin said, we need to hang in there together, or most assuredly we will hang separately. you know, this is a group effort, and we need to spread this message and many others to as many people as we can, because we're suffering for no reason other than lack of knowledge. So really, the person to be commended here is you, for taking the stand that you have and for developing the forum that you've developed to disseminate this information, because it's people like you that will, in fact, change the world. And my hat goes off to you, Jan. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.